So with those very brief technical reminders and not seeing any other messages coming into the queue, I think we are ready to get started with today's session. So I'm going to call up the presentation materials here as I invite Stuart Walker to turn on his video. And as we're getting Stuart ushered over to the stage, I did want to introduce your primary presenter, Stuart Walker, who has been here at the EPA since 1990 in either the Superfund program or in the Office of Radiation and Indoor Air, where he was working on issues regarding the cleanup of contaminated sites. His primary area of responsibility includes, pardon me, serving as the Superfund program's national lead on issues regarding radioactively contaminated CERCLA sites. In this role, Stuart develops national policy for risk assessment, including models, community involvement, compliance with ARARS, those applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, and establishing cleanup levels and management of radioactive contamination at CERCLA sites. So it is my pleasure to introduce Stuart to you, and let me turn the floor over to Stuart to get the session started. Stuart, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Jean. So I'll get started here on our little webinar today about correcting some of the misconceptions about EPA's Superfund approach for radiation risk assessment. And just a disclaimer, this is not an official EPA policy. This presentation, it's the views of this author. And if I mention any trade names or commercial products, they should not be interpreted as an endorsement by US EPA. So the purpose of today's talk is to provide some clarification of some of the misunderstandings about our approach used by the EPA Superfund site remediation program when dealing with radiation risk assessment, and focusing on some of the misstatements that I've seen often, primarily from folks that are more radiation professionals and usually not as familiar with Superfund. So, brief overview of our approach, Superfund approach to how we deal with radiation. In the Superfund program, we select cleanup levels for radioactive contaminations for sites generally using a cancer risk range of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6. That's basically in the 1 in 10,000 to 1 in a million, rather than millirem or millisieverts. Superfund uses slope factors when estimating cancer risk from radioactive contaminants instead of converting from millirem. And current slope factors or risk coefficients in Federal Guidance 13 updated slightly using ICRP 107 data. So when we do our risk-based cleanups, we try to use 10 to the minus 6 as a point of departure and establish preliminary remediation goals at 1 times 10 to the minus 6. PRGs are not based on other environmental standards or regulations or different environmental laws or facility siting laws, which are known as applicable or relevant appropriate requirements, or ARARs. They are risk-based then. If they're not based on ARARs, they're risk-based. So how to address radiation in what is essentially a chemical cleanup program. So there are a lot of sites on the national priorities list, which is the sites that the Superfund remedial program has been focused on. When I was checking on this, it was 1,789 total, with I think 66 of those are radioactively contaminated. All the ones that are radioactively contaminated, though, are also chemically contaminated, at least in the Superfund remedial program. So the question, how best to address radiation, and the answer that was answered in my program going back almost 35 years ago, was address radiation in a consistent manner with chemicals, except to account for the technical differences posed by radiation. And why is that? It's because radiation easily fits within a Superfund framework. It improves public confidence by taking mystery out of radiation. If you've worked on radiation sites, you will see that the public is usually more concerned with radiation contamination than just about than any other contaminants we deal with. And as mentioned, radioactively contaminated NPL sites also have chemical contamination, so we have to clean up both. So, quick overview of some of the tools we have out there when we're doing risk-based cleanups. We use the preliminary remediation goal or PRG calculator to address the soil, water and air, or contamination in soil, water, and air. That was originally issued in 2002. It's probably had about 20 or so updates. Then there's the BPRG, or Building Preliminary Remediation Goal Calculator, for inside radioactively contaminated buildings, first issued in 2007. A lot of updates there too. Thing to remember about that, it's basically looking at cleanup levels if you're going to reuse the building. It's not for determining if you knock the building down where the debris can go. It does not address that scenario. And then there's the SPRG, for outside hard surfaces, like fixed contamination on the outside wall of a building or the sidewalks or street, and then dust that may be in the streets or sidewalks. And they're looking at windblown resuspension of the contamination, and also by cars and trucks kicking that dust up. Then there are dose-based calculators that do the same things, except for dose-based standards, the DCC, BDCC, SDDCs. And the RVISL, which is the Radon Vapor Intrusion Level Calculator, came out in 2021. All the dates next to these are the initial dates they came out, but they've been updated since they came out. And then on the chemical side, we have the RSL calculator, which is very similar to the PRG calculator. Again, covering soil, water, and air. The BPRG calculators and BDCC were primarily based a lot on the World Trade Center document for cleanup after the 9/11. And then there's a vapor intrusion screening level calculator from 2018. But I often encounter incorrect assertions about our approach for addressing radioactively contaminated sites. And so these assertions often show up in things like journal articles, told to EPA personnel. I get calls from regional staff where they hear this from people they're interacting with. I've been in meetings up to the administrator where someone was telling them incorrect stuff that we're talking about. So, and often said in public meetings. So, then these things are things I have to help correct down the road. So hopefully, if we do this webinar, I'll have to do less correcting in the future. So some of the assertions that I hear, incorrect assertions, I should say. Number one, EPA's approach of addressing radioactive chemicals and a similar approach has not received any outside high-level review, either from a risk management policy perspective or a scientific review. The correct assertion two is that EPA risk assessment models have not been peer reviewed. Three is EPA is not using sound science. Four, EPA's risk models result in dramatically different results from other models assessing the same scenario. The next slide. So EPA is five is EPA is using population risk modeling incorrectly. Six, EPA's risk models are only for screening. Seven, EPA's cleanup level is either 12 or 15 millirem or 0.12 or 0.15 millisieverts instead of using the risk range. So, on the remaining slides we're talking about today, I'll briefly refute these incorrect assertions that continue to be made, unfortunately. And hopefully, this will help clear up some of the continuing confusion, and I won't have to keep doing this talk at conferences. So let's go through the first incorrect assertion that the EPA Superfund approach of addressing chemical and radioactive contamination in a consistent manner has not received high-level review. So let's go why that is incorrect. So this misconception is usually made from individuals not aware of various high-level reports from say a presidential congressional blue ribbon committee, the National Academy of Science, or NAS, EPA Science Advisory Board, so SAB, or ISCORS, which is a federal agency consensus group that we meet quarterly talking about different issues that people that in the federal government and some states that work on radiation issues. Okay, so let's first go through the Blue Ribbon Committee because that goes back a little ways too. So the President's Congressional Commission on Risk Assessment and Risk Management, which looked at a slew of environmental type programs across the federal agency, developed a 1997 report to Congress on the appropriate uses of risk assessment and risk management in federal regulatory programs. So the final report, there also was a volume two issued in 1997, and titled Risk Assessment and Risk Management Regulatory Decision Making. And in that document, it was recommended that radiation chemicals should be addressed consistently, particularly when co-located, and that Superfund should continue to use the 10 to -4 to 10 to -6 cancer risk range and reasonably anticipated land use when we're making our cleanup decisions. And so on the left, you can see a little screenshot of the cover of the book. Gene was mentioning all these things show up in the links pages because it's sometimes hard to find some of these. You don't know where to look. And here's the recommendation for the first one, talking about comparability of rad and chemicals, and that the second recommendation on that we should continue to use the risk range and reasonably anticipated land use. Okay, a little slow moving on the slide. Oh, so moving on to the National Academy of Science, NAS, in 1999, they had a report on evaluations of guidelines for exposure to technically enhanced naturally occurring radioactive materials. And in that, NAS compared EPA's approach for risk assessment, so using slope factors or risk coefficients, and approach used by NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, using EDE, effective dose equivalent, and convert to risk. NAS found that EPA's approach was methodologically more rigorous for assessing risk from chronic exposure to radionuclides, the type of thing you're looking at when you're looking at cleaning up contaminated sites and also trying to sum the risk with chemical contamination. So they compared EPA and NRC risk management approaches and determined that the differences were a matter of policy and not science and should reflect societal values. So, and this is just some screenshots of the cover page and then some of the quotations, the page 222 of the NAS report. It's the same stuff I was just covering the slide. I always like to provide screenshots in case people don't want to look it up themselves. And another screenshot from page 234, talking about the determination of risk for any exposure situation is a matter of risk. Risk management is a matter of judgment, risk management policy, which presumably reflects societal values. It's clear that the determination of a limit on acceptable dose for any exposure situation is also entirely a matter of judgment, not of science. Also, in 1992, the EPA Science Advisory Board sent a letter to the EPA Administrator titled Commentary on Harmonizing Chemical and Radiation Risk Reduction Strategies. And that document, SAB, acknowledged that the EPA guidance for Superfund sites, which would include the cleanup of DOE sites under CERCLA, would use a consistent risk-based approach for addressing radioactive and chemical contamination in both risk assessment methodology and cleanup levels. So still including no more than 10 to -4 cancer risks. Now, SAB viewed the harmonization of radionuclides to the chemical approach as a scientifically valid one. So. And again, so this is the SAB, the cover title page of their commentary. And then the screenshot from page 9, they talk about referencing our risk assessment guidelines for Superfund rags and that it was going to be a consistent approach for radiation and chemicals for risk assessment. And let me just move on to the next one. And two more screenshots from page 10 and 12 of that same commentary from SAB, talking about that, there's a need for harmonization, how they're going to do it, how EPA would do it in different programs, that EPA needs to write out policies to allow staff, the regulated community, scientific consultants to work on them for both the agency and others, and the general public all to know what to expect in EPA's regulation of radioactive and other residual radioactivity and other radiation issues. So they were saying that it's the that there's no, they don't have any special insight on how the resolution should be accomplished. But in the previous slide, they said that the way that we were doing it was a valid approach, just that they, there could have been other choices too. And that EPA just needs to be clear on the making the choice, and then that they urge the choice be articulated clearly so people know which approach we're using, which we believe we've done. And so ISCOR is the Interagency Steering Committee on Radiation Standards. Ah, glad I included that. I always forget the, I always call it ISCORs. So, and then 2002, they did a report entitled A Method for Estimating Radiation Risk from Total Effective Dose Equivalent TETI. And this was a report was approved by EPA, NRC, DOE, DOD, and some other federal agencies. And in that report, ISCORS stated the simple method of converting dose to risk is insufficient for a complex risk assessment, such as those that we use at Superfund sites or CERCLA sites. And the recommendation from the agencies is to use slope factors when a complex risk assessment is needed for assessing radionuclides, such as those at CERCLA sites. I mean, but not, and then it talks about cases where you would also use a simple version, but I'm not going to talk about that because that's outside the scope of our program. And here again is the ISCORS screenshot, the title. You can see the screenshot with the logos of the agencies that signed off. And the quote that I just covered on the previous page is there's a screenshot. It's from right in the first paragraph, actually, when you go to the report. And Jane, if you were going to see if there were any questions, I think we're going to the second assertion.
Yep, we do have a handful of questions that came in. So I'll just provide a gentle reminder to the audience that we will be pausing several times throughout our broadcast today. So I do encourage you to send your questions and comments in through the Q&A as soon as they occur to you so that I can bring them up during these designated breaks. We did have a question that came in earlier, Stuart, asking if EPA participated in something called the ICRP, the International Commission on Radiological Protection, if you were involved in any of their meetings, studies, and publications.
I have not been on any of their work groups. I do know EPA staff and managers that are currently and in the past.
Okay.
Mostly not so much, say, from our Superfund program, but from our Office of Radiation and Indoor Air. I know several people from that office that have been on ICRP work groups, and they're equivalent at the national level, the NCRP. So, and sometimes I work, they're asking me for information to, if they're having a topic on site remediation, I can provide for them to provide for ICRP. So.
Okay. And then there was a comment just about a lot of the references that have been cited are several decades old. And they're just curious with new science and new technology and just a general evolution in our hazardous waste cleanup professional community. Is EPA in the process of updating any of the policies or practices that you were citing?
Well, we continually update those models. So when I mentioned things like the PRG calculator, which is probably the earliest model I had up listed there, was 2002. I think the last update for that was last summer. It probably has mostly smaller updates almost every year, but every 3-4 years there's a pretty significant update. I mean, it just depends on when we finish things. Things like the RSL calculator for chemicals, that's updated on a schedule, updated twice a year, every year. So just like putting down the initial dates, if I gave the impression that those things have not been updated since then. Some of the other reports out there, like the Blue Ribbon Commission, that would be the president and Congress saying, well, gee, we want to have another massive review of all these different regulatory programs. That would not be an EPA thing to start. Like some of the things like the SAB reports, I don't think we've asked for anything like that. Like we were asking back on the commentary, back in the early 90s on how to do risk harmonization, because programs have made decisions on how to move in that direction and have been just implementing things like that and updating things since then. So We just don't go back and change our complete approach. I think it was more of a early regulatory set of questions we were asking different groups to try and ensure we're on the right path, but.
And then we just had a question about historical methodology that EPA may have used prior to the publication of the BPRGs. They're curious, what was EPA's method for calculating risk from buildings?
There was no set EPA policy for looking at radioactive contamination in buildings. So that was the first one. So the PRG calculator for soil, that was predated by the soil screening guidance for radionuclides calculator, which came out in 2000. And then that was predated before by the RAGS risk assessment guidance for Superfund Part B that had PRG equations for chemicals and radionuclides, and that came out in 1991.
Okay. And then we do have one other question that's talking a bit about EPA's modeling approaches that kind of incorporate the complexities of the environmental situations. They're really asking about evaluation of potential synergistic effects between radiation exposure and chemical exposure that could be affecting the same organ system. They note that radiation carcinogenicity might be evaluated using sort of like a one-hit model, while the chemical carcinogenicity might be a multi-hit model. And they were curious if EPA has a model that might reflect both of these.
We for Superfund sites, we calculate both the chemical and radiation risks separately for cancer, and then we add them together. There's all types of discussions for years on trying to improve the science on whether things are synergistic, and that would be more of an effect than just adding them together, or antagonistic, which would be less of an effect. And the science is just not there to move away from the simple additive. There's always research in those efforts, but again, that's led out of, say, our research and Office of Research and Development, or Office of Radiation Indoor Air, that both work on slope factors for chemicals and radionuclides. So I can't really speak to where the status of any of that research is, other than I've not heard anything that imminently we're going to improve moving from additive.
All
And
right,
I do ask that periodically, by the way.
Excellent, thank you. I don't see any other questions in the queue. So I think in the interest of time, we can carry on with the presentation. I'll just make a quick note. It is 1:58 p.m. Eastern.
Okay, so the second incorrect assertion, Superfund risk assessment models have not been peer reviewed. Let's go through how that is wrong. So each of the four models for radiation risk assessment, Superfund sites, the PRG, BPRG, SPRG, and RVISL, have undergone independent external peer review and verification review. And when I say that, I'm saying it's based on the criteria that EPA has laid out in an overall EPA document called the Guidance on the Development, Evaluation, and Application of Environmental Models, or what I call the CREM document. And we also do additional automatic computer verification occurs, both of the modeling and also now the links in the on the user guides, the online user guides. So here's a quick little summary of each type of review. So independent external peer review, we do that. That we actually have a contractor that picks the peer reviewers. I do not get to pick them. Then they summarize the comments and we respond to that in a table. Non-independent is we usually have chosen a group that we typically use under an IAG or interagency agreement, the Center for Excellence from the Army Corps of Engineers, as additional reviewers as we go through drafts. To besides having the EPA people look at it, also give you also pay the Corps to look at it to give us comments. Then we have an independent external verification review. Again, the contractor picks the verification reviewers, and that's to check them. The calculation, the math. The peer review is checking more of the policy and are we explaining things? Does it make sense? And then, of course, there's internal verification, which often people refer to as just Q&A. QC. And then there's an auto check on the default and site runs for PRG and BPRG calculators. That's nightly. And then an auto check of default runs since 2019 for all four of the risk calculators. We're moving towards having the site-specific runs being checked for the SPRG and RVISL, but they're not there yet. And then an auto check now of all the links that you see, like when you go to the user guide, so that hopefully you won't go to the user guide and have broken links and not be able to find documents that we're referencing. So how to find these peer verification reviews? So basically, you go to the calculator you're interested, you go to the home page in the welcome section, third paragraph. There should be a link. So there's a screenshot over there showing you where you'd look for it. And that's for the PRG calculator, but it's basically the same for all the calculators. That little paragraph blown up that you saw on the previous slide. So the PRG calculator results were previously verified. The documentation for these seen on the internal verification and external verification pages. Also, PRG calculators previously peer-reviewed, and the documentation of those peer reviews may be seen here. So you see links there. Other types of reviews we had, we also mentioned, and you can have links to those. So we can see what people are commenting on and how they have and how we've responded to some of those comments too. So here's a page when you go to look at the external peer review record, a little bit of explanation of what we're trying to accomplish with having peer reviews. This is language I took out of the EPA document on how to evaluate models, the CREM document. And then for each of the peer reviews, so you can see for the independent peer reviews, there's all the comments is the first link. And then the second link is a summary of the comments with the EPA responses. And so you can see that for both of the independent peer reviews. And then below those are the dependent or non-independent peer reviews. So you can see, so those are from the Army Corps of Engineers. So you can see the comments that they made for us. So that's not quite as formal though. And then if you go clicked on the external verification explanation of what we're checking with the verification, basically making sure the math works for the model. And again, you see the package, the commenters. And both that for that and the peer review, you also see if there's any conflict of interest and statement, that kind of thing, what the background of the people who are reviewing these are. And usually there's not a response because there's an error. Or somebody fixes or brings up something, we fix it. But that's also referenced in the any change that changes the model is referenced in the what's new section of the model. So you can see the reviews there. And go to the next slide. Error's not working all the time. And then the internal verification record. So when we're doing checks, like every time there's a new version, we go through a verification process to make sure it's working correctly, and that's posted. We didn't always post those. So I mean, we're always doing the verification, like say for the PRG calculator going back to 2002 or 2003, but we didn't keep track of those, so you can only find copies of it going back, I think 2010. But we were doing the checks before, we just weren't documenting them to the same extent we are now. And that's people have asked to see copies of what we were doing as far as the reviews. Okay, Gene, I'd move on to the third incorrect assertion if anyone does have a clarifying question they want answered.
There was a question, but it's about consistent radiation and chemical risk assessment being used in the context of occupational exposure. So they're just wondering, yeah, you come to that one later.
Not really, but probably occupational would as far as workers would be more of a OSHA issue. So I don't work on that.
Okay,
It's
got it.
not a
Thank you.
topic that we're covering.
Okay. All right, well, then let's carry on.
Okay, third incorrect assertion, EPA is not using sound science in its Superfund radiation risk assessment models. So to push back on that one. EPA has an IAG with an interagency agreement with the Department of Energy's Oak Ridge National Laboratory to develop and to keep updated based on new science and EPA policies, the EPA risk and dose assessment and radon intrusion models. So that's the PRG, BPRG, SPRG for risk, dose, DDC, BDCC, SDCC, and radon RVSL. We work with the Center for Radiation Protection Knowledge, which is part of Ornell's Environmental Sciences Division, which manages the work. During the development of PRG and DCC calculators, one of the key people we were working with at that point was Keith Eckerman, who is recipient of the 12th Swedish Royal Academy Gold Medal. So those are given out once, I think, every 4 years. Try to move to the next slide.
Stuart, bear with me. I'm going to call the slides up here on a different screen, okay? All right. Give me one moment. I apologize for that brief interruption. And I'll just take this. Go ahead.
No, no. I was just waiting to see. I just have a big picture of myself, right?
No, that's okay. I'm calling the slides up here on a different screen. And then we're going to swap out the view here in just a moment. Again, I apologize for that brief interruption, everyone. But as we're waiting to call these slides back up, I will remind everyone the Q&A space is available. We can take just one question while I'm calling this up. One of the attendees was just curious if EPA has reached out to other organizations beside the Army Corps of Engineers for peer reviews.
Not for the non-independent ones. It's because we have an existing IAG with them for a lot of work, including risk assessment work. So they because they're also familiar with Superfund, they do a lot of work with us both on risk assessment. They have their own sites under a FUSRAP program that they're addressing. They also deal often with working with people on the NRC side. So they're used to our tools, they're used to DOE's tools. So they have a lot of experience in the US. So that's why we kind of focus with them. But we do often have peer reviewers from a whole host of groups we have in the independent peer review. So I suggest sometimes, usually we have about five people, we'll try to get at least two international folks. Sometimes we're reaching out to groups like IAEA to see who, if they have any people they can recommend on a certain particular issue. So you'll see, if you look at the peer reviews, the independent peer reviews listed and the reviewers we have there, you'll see a pretty wide group.
All right, excellent. And I do apologize for that disruption there, Stuart, but it looks like the slides are back up and you should have control.
Okay, let's see. Yeah, it did. Okay, it did move. So working with DOE ORNL, that's continued. So KZ Morgan, who used to run the ORNL's health visit division, was also an early recipient of the Swedish Royal Academy Gold Medal for Radiation Protection and started the ORNL Dosimetry Research Program in the 1950s. Since it started, that program has provided the national and international scientific communities with models and data required to estimate radiation doses and risks to establish guidelines for radionuclides. So our Office of Radiation Indoor Air works with them when they come up with the risk coefficients for, say, Federal Guidance 13. And EPA works with ORNL to help bring this knowledge of sound science on radiation to help appropriately address radiation within the Superfund framework. So they've issued a lot of ORNL technical manuals and other publications that are developed specifically to support the EPA Superfund calculator. So when you're in things like the user guide, there will be links to an ORNL technical manual often that's underlying the EPA calculator. And so moving on to the fourth incorrect assertion, I don't know if there's any clarifying questions on that last one.
We did have a question about if a building is not going to be used again, would you use the outside surface PRG or just a site one?
If it was going to not be used again, but you mean to dispose of it?
They didn't clarify, and I might ask the questioner if they could provide just a few clarifying points on it. And then yes, she is actually replying and say yes when they're just going to dispose of it.
Then that would be getting into waste acceptance criteria of the disposal unit that you're sending it to.
All right.
We have a specialized process for looking at if it's going to a non-NRC licensed landfill for doing a risk assessment for that. But often there's state regulations that may have waste acceptance criteria or NRC, if it's going to an NRC or state agreements, NRC agreement state license landfill, then there would be waste acceptance criteria for that. Less a Superfund cleanup question, though.
Okay. I do see another question that came in. This is actually a two-part question. The first one is asking, how does EPA assess risks for compounds that possess cancer toxicities for both their chemical properties and their radioactivities? Are both risks considered additive when you're calculating cumulative risks?
Yes. I mean, if you can develop a risk assessment for both the radioactive portion and the chemical. But one thing you'll notice, though, is even when there is a chemical that we address, but if there's a radionuclide of it, the radiation tends to risk tends to dwarf the chemical risk, except for with uranium isotopes. And so if there's something that's covered in the RSL calculator, and it's also the elements covered in the RSL calculator, then the radionuclides covered in the PRG calc, you'd have to do calculations on both. But the only thing for radionuclides we really focus on looking at the chemical toxicity is total uranium. And one of the things is when you run the radiation calculators, the PRG calculator, it'll give you an answer both in activity, so picocuries per gram, becquerels per gram, and then you will also get milligram per kilogram, so it gives you mass. And you see that the cleanup levels for radionuclides that we're cleaning up are very, very, very low as terms of in terms of mass. So the chemical toxicity of radionuclides is just it's just dwarfed. So for the radionuclides when we're cleaning up, we don't actually worry about those, the chemical toxicity, except for total uranium. So often I'll see the mass if you when you run the calculator for milligrams per kilogram won't be say a number, it'll be 0 point 15, 20 zeros and then a number. So it's really small mass because the risk is coming from the radiation being released, not the chemical toxicity.
Okay, and then a second part to that question, they noted that for uranium, they noticed that the RSL only lists non-cancer screening levels. Does
Right.
that mean that the cancer risks from radioactivities should be assessed separately using those models that were mentioned in the presentation?
Yes. And
Okay.
we actually have a guidance called a risk assessment guidance. Radiation risk assessment at Circle Sites Q&A guidance came out in 2014. And that specifically mentions that you would need to use the radiation calculators for looking at the cancer risk and the RSL, or if it's inside a building, the World Trade Center type of risk assessment document for the chemical toxicity to actually a kidney toxin for total uranium.
There was also a question here. How would you calculate risk from a truck hauling AUM waste material?
We it is not built into the calculators, but the calculators have been adjusted to do that type of assessment for some site-specific waste disposal questions. I would suggest contacting us, so we could probably try to get you the documentation or contacting the region that you're looking at examples of how we've done it in the past, because they're not on the internet. It's more of a site-specific risk assessment, but we could talk to you about that. But it's not, yeah, there's not a set policy on that right now.
Okay. I do see a few other questions that are coming in just about partnerships and how different entities are working with one another. What I think we might do is hold those questions for later. We do have some additional time at the end of the presentation as well. So, Stuart, in the interest of time, why don't we go ahead with the fourth incorrect assertion, and then we'll pause again for another Q&A break shortly.
Okay. So the other one, fourth and one incorrect assertion is that EPA Superfund radiation risk assessment models are very conservative compared to other models. And for some reason, this keeps coming up, particularly focused on the United Kingdom's approach. So in general, sometimes incorrect assertions are made that EPA's PRG calculators are ultra conservative compared to some of the other models. And this misconception, I think, is often because users are not accounting for the different risk management frameworks or conceptual site models that are behind these calculators. So, in the default target risk in the PRG calculator is 1 × 10^-6 or 1 in a million. It's not 25 millirem, which is about 5 × 10^-4, which, say, NRC starts off with, or 100 millirem, which some other guidance and other countries sometimes use that, or they call it 1 millisievert. That's more of a 2 × 10^-3 risk. And the defaults of the PRG tools are intended for consistency with how we do chemical assessment under CERCLA. And so we're not looking at trying to be consistent with how radiation models are for other laws or in other countries. For example, in Superfund, the PRG calculator is using the standard Superfund scenario, which is a highly exposed individual, we call the reasonable maximum exposure scenario. Whereas, say, in the NRC world, you're often using the average member of the critical group. So we're not using that approach. So, the United Kingdom comparison that keeps coming up, and it's an example of an incorrect comparison of PRG tool with another model. I'll bring this up because I keep seeing this assertion for years in different places. So it's been asserted that the United Kingdom cleaned up a polonium-210 after the Levetco poisoning incident, allowed concentrations that were over 900,000 times higher than those allowed by EPA's PRG calculator. Most recently, it was in a 2023 letter to the editor of the Health Physics Society Journal. Some similar recent claims have been in a webinar from 2022 from American Nuclear Society, and another Health Physics Society letter claimed that the UK allowed over 19,000 times higher levels than the Superfund PRG calculators. And also, the annual meeting of HPS in 2021 is allowed. Claimed the UK allowed 28,329 times higher. I keep seeing the same assertions, but just the numbers keep jumping all over the place. So there are several problems with these assertions. I'll make them incorrect, and I'll discuss this over several slides. So these claims correctly cite part of the UK cleanup level polonium-210 of 10 becquerel per centimeter squared to equate to 1 millisievert or 100 millirem. This was for fixed contamination. These claims do not include the UK cleanup level for polonium-210 of removable contamination, which was non-detect or 0 becquerels per centimeter squared. There's a screenshot of the UK guidance there and key pages and stuff yellow highlighted on the on their recommended cleanup levels. So not that it seems like the wrong tool is being run. So like in the letter to editor writer, they ran the SPRG calculator for a scenario of dust on roadways. Then they only used the results from eating the dust and picked an output option. Secular equilibrium that does not account for decay as if the re contamination were to be replenished. So that basically in that scenario, it's not a one-time poisoning where you left the dust out and then it's decaying away because polonium-210's got a short half-life. It's as if someone is taking contaminated dust and dropping it out there every day for the next 30 or 26 years. So the writer also used the target risk level, the more stringent end of the risk range, 1 × 10^-6, rather than the more typical highest allowed which would be more like around 1 × 10⁴. So they were looking at more the de minimis level. They did those runs. And below is just a run I did to try to simulate what they did using the SPRG calculator. So, yeah, if you're using SPRG calculator for dust, you know, using just ingestion didn't make sense when you're inhalation and from resuspending the waste is also external exposure. But, yeah, that was very odd that they chose that. So, letter to editor writer got a concentration of 0.00011 becquerels per centimeter square for polonium-210 at a risk level of 1 × 10⁶, which is a de minimis risk level, and also the wrong tool to use. So, using the typical upper bound for target risk of 1 × 10⁴, and using the BPRG output option that accounts for decay, which is what I would have told a region if they were running this for a similar type of incident of one-time release. The polonium 210 concentrations I got are for settled dust 0.0172 becquerel per centimeter squared, and for 3D fix much higher level. So and that's because polonium's not really giving you much risk from external exposure, and we do fixed in Superfund, we're assuming that you are not disturbing it or breaking the wall apart. So So comparing, contrasting my simple run with the UK cleanup concentrations indicate that the UK is actually more stringent for both fixed 3D and mobile dust contamination. So for fixed, they're a lot more stringent, and that's because they were assuming that some of the wall gets damaged and then becomes dust. And so they were worried about accidents happening. And for mobile dust, their non-detect was, you know, zero is less than a really small number that we had, although they're essentially really both really low. So because polonium 210 is really bad if you ingest it, so those assertions by that we've seen are wrong. So one thing about this, my little analysis I just went through is extremely superficial. Since it's comparing results and not the underlying input parameters that are used. So somebody's really trying to look in, well, let's say the BPRG inputs were also intended for consistency with the World Trade Center cleanup. And then we've updated them twice based on updates in the EPA's exposure factors handbook. So we weren't focused on consistency with the United Kingdom on when we were doing that. We were focused on the consistency with the response after 9/11, because that's a U.S. response. And they were using, that's where our focus was on consistency. So lesson you should draw from these inaccurate Superfund UK risk dose polonium 210 comparisons. It's also to view some of these analysis skeptically, and especially when you're seeing analysis when they're conducted by people that were not in either one of those programs, since they may not understand either program. And so when I did my simple evaluation, I did at least contact the people in the UK, who at least I knew one of them. I remember having talked with his boss about how they did the cleanup, so I just reached out to them, make sure I wasn't mischaracterizing what they did. Okay, that's it for the fourth incorrect assertion.
Okay, Stuart, there are a few questions that came in while you were speaking, although I think they're jumping around a bit in their focus area. There was someone who did share a link to an energy.gov documents on transport risk assessment. So in just a little while, Stuart, I'll have you double check on that link, and then we can post that with the other resources if it's relevant for the individual who is asking about a truck risk model. One of the questions that came in, if you were leaving a radioactive building foundation below ground after D&D, would you use the SPRG or just PRG?
You're looking at a building slab?
Yeah, it looks like a radioactive building foundation below ground.
Yeah, it's an SPRG 2D scenario.
Okay. Right, thank you. We do have some questions about updating guidance, like, for example, the newest quote, Blue Book, EPA radiogenic cancer risk models and projections for the US population. This EPA guidance came from 2011. Any plans to update that guidance?
That's a different office, the Office of Radiation
Okay.
and Indoor Air. They're working on the update to Federal Guidance 13, which I think they're going to call Federal Guidance 16, but I will not try to give any other information other than I know they're working on it because I'm on the work group.
All right, excellent. Our next question, this is a specific one, is the approximation of 25 millirem per year to a 5 to the 10 to the minus 4 cancer risk based on a particular exposure scenario? They just go on to ask if you're not specifying an exposure duration, isn't equating a dose rate to cancer risk a sort of apples to oranges comparison?
Yes, it is. It's approximately, and we've done an analysis where we looked at different isotopes. I think it was maybe about 60 isotopes across different land uses, and it averaged out to about 5 times to the minus 4. But it was off by, say, an order of magnitude in either direction. So it could be up to 10 to the minus 3, 5 times to the minus 3, 5 times to the minus 5, depending on the isotope. So, yes, it is not a direct correlation, which is why I talked before about the ISCOR's recommendation that when you're trying to do a comprehensive risk assessment where the risk is the focus of the regulatory program, that's why they say to use the risk coefficients and not do dose to risk conversion. So.
Okay. And Stuart, someone acknowledged that you've been doing this work for decades, and they're very grateful for all of your efforts just to share information and keep things consistent and awareness of all of these policies and procedures. But they're wondering, is EPA formally working on bringing in or increasing their capacity by having other staff trained with your institutional knowledge? They're particularly concerned about the void if and when you retire.
Yeah, that's come up. We do a lot of training internally. And we do meetings with the regions every 2 years or 2 or 3 years, used to every year for the GSA scandal. Yeah, succession planning is a topic, but there's also limits on how many people we can hire. So I don't currently have somebody working with me as a younger replacement. We do try to keep training people that are in other offices and in regions on what we're doing. And much of the material things that I talk about, I also, if they're not things that are like guidance documents that show up on the internet page, they are on our SharePoint and intranet page, so that I make our regional staff aware of those. So,
Okay.
and that's always and that's been something they were asking for 25 years ago. So, Stuart, if you get hit by a bus, no one's going to be able to find this. So, please post it. We can all find it.
All right. Thank you. I don't see any other questions in the queue for now, so why don't we carry on with our next incorrect assertion and we'll pause again in just a few moments.
Okay, so the fifth incorrect assertion is that Superfund radiation risk assessment approaches incorrectly using population and risk estimates. It has been claimed that Superfund's policy for risk-based cleanup is directly going against or in opposition to the recommendation by the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, UNSCEAR, which is to not estimate population effects from low-level exposures to radiation. So I'll talk about why that's wrong. So in 2012, UNSCEAR recommended against the practice of basing population risk from lower exposures and their document sources, effects, and risk of ionizing radiation. And there's their quote, at least the 30th point in the there. I'm not going to read it, but they're saying don't do that. But what Superfund does is we don't do that at all. So when we do cleanup levels, we're using a Superfund RME exposure scenario for establishing risk-based cleanup levels. This is based on a high-end estimate for individual risk. So in our risk assessment guidance for radiation risk assessment guidance for surplus sites Q&A, which came out in 2014, we talk about population risks generally not being used for Superfund risk assessments or to establish cleanup levels. So basically, our policy is not to use population risk. We may use it for more information, but not to base our cleanup levels on that. However, many federal regulatory processes must evaluate population risk. So, while Superfund decisions are based on RME, not population risk, that's not the case with some of our other federal regulatory decisions. And since the 70s, federal agencies consider the costs and benefits of when developing regulations that would be expected to have large economic effects. So, they look at evaluating a number of cancer cases or deaths caused by cancer avoided by different proposed alternatives that were under consideration in a regulation. And this would require evaluating population health effects. So this comes out of cost-benefit analysis of regulations required by two executive orders that are issued by the White House, so coming from our president at the time. So EO 12866, Regulatory Planning and Review, came out in 1993, and also 13563, Improving Regulation and Regulatory Review, which came out under 2011. So federal regulatory agencies that have to follow these, have to follow the executive orders that come out of the White House. They don't get overruled by an unsecured recommendation. So, Gene, that's it for the fifth incorrect assertion.
Okay, I don't see anything new in the queue for right now, so why don't we carry on? I will note we do have some other questions that came in earlier, but I'm going to hold those ones till the end.
Okay, maybe they're getting tired. So, yeah. All right, so moving on to the sixth incorrect assertion. EPA Superfund radiation risk assessment models are only to be considered or only to be used for screening. So let's go why that is wrong. So the misconception that EPA's PRG calculators are intended for screening can occur when someone does not understand the role of screening and preliminary remediation goals that we use for risk and dose assessment for Superfund sites. The role of the PRG calculator for radionuclides and aerosol calculator for chemicals and screening and/or PRGs versus risk assessment, or also they don't understand how that this Superfund approach is different from the screening that is used in the world regulatory world of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So we both use the term screening in our guidance documents, but they mean different things in our two regulatory programs. So the NCP or National Contingency Plan, which is the regulatory language for Superfund, under 40 CFR 40, the code CFR's Code of Federal Regulations, section 300.430. I'm going to throw the clauses after that. So basically, it says develop PRGs based on readily available information. You modify PRGs as necessary as more information becomes available, and you select the final remediation goals in the Record of Decision or ROD. So the role of the baseline risk assessment for Superfund remedy decisions with the guidance came out in 1991. It talked about that PRGs are developed early in the process based on readily available information such as ARRs, 10 to the minus 6 cancer risk, or hazard index of 1 for non-carcinogens. PRGs may be modified by the results of a baseline risk assessment by info such as clarifying the exposure pathways or multiple contaminants or pathways. And the final decision may modify PRGs based on waste management strategy. And so that's a screenshot of the guidance there, and the screen and highlighted some of the text that I'm using for the bullets. So another guidance came out in 1996 was the soil screening guidance for chemicals. Well, it just said soil screening guidance user guide, but that was for chemicals. And that talks about screening being used to identify and defining areas and then chemicals, or then later when you did radionuclides, conditions, and also conditions at a particular site that do not require further federal attention. So soil screening levels can be used as PRGs, is what they were saying in that document. And then in 2000, we did a radiation version of the soil screening guides. Again, it's to identify and define the areas, radionuclide conditions at a particular site that do not require further federal attention. Soil screening levels, again, can be used as PRGs. So we used a lot of the same language in the soil screening guides for radionuclides that had already showed up in the one from 1996, the original soil screening guides for SSG. And in the technical background document for the chemicals SSG, part three included additional, more complicated models for the detailed assessment of soil to groundwater. There were nine soil to groundwater models listed that were more complicated than a simple screening approach that was just for that was part of the original SSG. And then we did the SSG for radionuclides in 2000. We used to look at five more sophisticated soil to groundwater models. So the idea being when you had a more when you want to move away from screening for soil to groundwater, we switched to a different model, not for risk assessment. And in the radiation risk assessment at CERCLA sites Q&A, which came out in 2014, I've mentioned that a few times. We've also talked about using the PRG calculator for determining SSLs or soil screening levels for screening purposes. For generic assessments, use the faults in the PRG and DCC calculators. And use the PRG and DCC calculators for risk and dose assessments because these are consistent with how chemicals are being assessed under CERCLA. So the how they're consistent with how it's being done for the RSL calculator. So where is the confusion? Why do people get this wrong? I think probably some are more used to the NRC approach for modeling, some of the radiation tech folks. And they may think that the NRC approach for modeling is transferable over to CERCLA sites. Let me emphasize, it is not. It is a completely different regulatory program. So next few slides quote some of those NRC policies. And I'm not attacking NRC. NRC is just running a different regulatory program. So you can't just pick up things from their regulatory program and drop it in to the CERCLA compliance program. So NRC uses their model, the D&D, for screening dose assessments for soil and building surfaces. But it's NRC's policy not to use D&D for site-specific dose analysis. So, and there is a screenshot from their consolidated decommissioning guidance issued by NRC, and a couple screenshots from their that talk about the issues I was just talking about in the bullets above. This is a really long guide, so that's why you're going to be happy if you want to go back and look through it that I actually put the screenshot up here. Now, NRC accepts for screening concentrations in either a table for soil and buildings based on D&D runs, or you can do is a modeling run using D&D. So, I put a screenshot of what the tables look like here on the screen too. But for site-specific analysis, NRC recommends that ResRad or ResRad Build are used for those site-specific analysis. So in the NRC world, they do screening with one model, and then when they go to a more site-specific analysis, they switch to a different model. So that is very different than what we do in Superfund. I'm just pointing out that these are two regulatory programs that have differences, and you don't try to do the same thing. You don't try to mix them up. When you're in NRC world, you follow the NRC guidance. When you're in EPA CERCLA world, you should be following the EPA guidance. So the NRC approach is not relevant to CERCLA risk or dose assessment. So for EPA for CERCLA, we use the same models, say for soil, PRG, RSL, DCC, for chemical risk assessment, radiological risk, and dose assessment. That is both for generic screening and for site-specific assessments. And then the NRC uses two different models for generic screening. They use D&D. And then for site-specific, they use ResRad for their dose assessments. Both EPA and NRC allow for the use of other models, but they must be reviewed and approved by staff. So one of my jobs is if we're looking, region is evaluating the consideration of their model, they're supposed to consult with me at headquarters with the federal facility. They also consult with our federal facilities office together. So, but we don't just jump to another model. So what do you do? Well, when you're in the CERCLA world, use the CERCLA approach when conducting screening and risk assessments at CERCLA sites. So I think that's kind of simple. And so conclusions for incorrect assertions 5 and 6. It seems like both incorrect assertions 5 and 6 seem to be based on people confusing Superfund with either NRC's decommissioning program or other federal government regulatory programs. So hopefully people will not make that mistake if they've listened to this webinar. And Jean, see if there's any additional questions.
Okay, we did have a few that came in. One of the attendees just asked, do the soil to groundwater models take into account karst geology?
It has been so long since I reviewed. I was working with our soil to groundwater people and they were doing that review. I am not going to try and guess what those models actually included. But if you look at the soil screening guidance for radionuclides and the one for chemical, the one from 1996 and 2000, there's a chapter 3 in that technical background document that does a summary of the models that are reviewed.
Okay.
So that should be hard to go back and look up, but I just don't remember at this point.
Okay. And then in the context of the misconceptions you were talking about in the session, can you explain why the ORNL models, ORNL, are more appropriate than the models developed by Argonne National Lab, ANL?
Well, for Superfund, and I'm not talking about for Superfund because I'm not... ORNL works with us on both our radiation and our chemical models. So when I was originally planning to develop the SSG for radionuclides calculator, I was looking at some contractor options. And Dave Bennett, who used to run with our manager in Superfund over the risk assessment modeling, I was in a different group. I was also focused a lot on ARs at the time. We had a meeting and he said, why are you not going to use RNL? We were using them on chemical. And I was like, I didn't even know that they had started working with the lab when they did the chemical, the SSG calculator. And since they're also the same people that work with us, our radiation office on the slope factors, they have both the Superfund experience and then they're the leading portion of DOE on health effects of radiation. So that seemed like a good mesh. And after he explained that to me, I like, yep, totally agree with you. And so that's what we've been working with them ever since on the calculator. So SSG for radionuclides at first, and then the PRG, and then all these other ones since then. So so that's why I think they are the best, you know, fit for purpose on developing our tools. And it makes it easy because some of the same people that work on the chemical tools also work on the radiation tools. And we have some of the senior radiation scientists then help those people out on my tools where they don't work on the chemical tools. So.
Okay. All right. I think we're going to pause with the Q&A break here and we'll come back in just a minute. So carry on with the presentation.
So let's get to the seventh incorrect assertion. And, EPA Superfund cleanup standard is 12 or 15 millirem, 0.12 or 0.15 millisieverts. And I almost did not include this one, and then a region brought it up to me again. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to add this in. So this misconception that EPA's cleanup levels for radioactively contaminated sites began in the 1990s. There was a 1997 guidance document that we issued that I basically wrote, establishment of cleanup levels for CERCLA sites with radioactive contamination. And EPA stated that cleanup levels for radionuclides not based on an AROR should use atenomize 4 to atenomize 6 cancer risk range. So some screenshots from there talking about where ARRs are not available or sufficiently protective. We set site-specific remediation levels using the risk range. And these are all screenshots from that same guidance, basically saying use a risk range for these cleanups. Use slope factors when you're developing these risk-based numbers. Some of the risks from radionuclides and chemicals together. So that's all, that's what those screenshots are saying. But in the 1997 guidance, there was one paragraph that meant users could also conduct a dose assessment in addition to a risk assessment, not in lieu of a risk assessment. So if you wanted to also do a dose assessment, you could, but you still had to do a risk assessment. So even in that sentence, referring to 15 millirem, the guidance states that the cleanup level still must achieve the 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 6 cancer risk range. And that sentence caused us a number of problems on confusion. So people were arguing, oh, you can just use 15 millirem. No, that's not what that said. So in 1999, so 3 years later, we had to, we're doing the radiation risk assessment for CERCLA-CITES Q&A. That's the precursor or the first version, the 2014 guidance I've mentioned a couple times, the update to that guidance. And that says that dose assessments should only be conducted under CERCLA where necessary to demonstrate AROR compliance, and that dose-based AROR should be 15 millirem per liter, 3 or less to be considered protective. But if there's no AROR, you don't do a dose assessment. So you only do the dose assessment if you're you have a dose-based standard that's an AROR that you're trying to show compliance. And so, and the transmittal memo to the regions that was signed by management, we tried to clarify that highlight that issue that people should not use 15 millirem as some kind of presumptive cleanup under level under CERCLA, but rather they should be using the risk range when not using ARRs. And that's some screenshots from the transmittal memo. It's on page 2 of the transmittal memo. I remember that painfully. And then also backwork, yeah, question 32, the answer, when should a dose assessment be performed? And I'll read it. I'll read this one. Cleanup levels not based on an AROR should be based on the carcinogenic risk range. Generally, 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6, with 10 to the minus 6 as the point of departure and 1 times 10 to the minus 4, 6 used for PRGs, and expressed in terms of risk. So number times 10 to the minus whatever. So then later on in that same paragraph, please note that references to 15 millirem and OSWER directive 9200.4-18, that's that 1997 guidance, are intended as guidance for the evaluation of potential ARRs and TBCs and should not be used as a TBC for establishing 15 millirem cleanup levels at CERCLA sites. At CERCLA sites, and we emphasize this, dose assessment should generally not be performed to assess risk or to establish cleanup levels, except to show compliance with an AROR that requires a dose assessment. Ah, I wish I would never have to say this again. Anyways, so in 2014, we updated the risk assessment Q&A, and it continued to provide guides that dose assessment should only be conducted under CERCLA where necessary to demonstrate AROR compliance. So there's the quote there. Now in question, it's now in the answer to question 33 instead of 32 from the 1999 guide. So, in the 2014 guidance, there is a revision that says when we're evaluating whether a dose-based standard, that's an AROR, should be considered protective, that you now would use 12 millirem or less, not the 15 millirem. And that is to, because the radiation, the simple dose to radiation, dose to risk conversion, which used to be that 15 millirem over 30 years was equated to 3 times 10 to the minus 4. Now it's 12 millirem over 30 years equated to 3 times 10 to the minus 4 based on the simple dose to risk conversion in Federal Guidance Report 13. So we look at that when we're looking at the risk from ARRs, but not when we're doing an actual risk assessment. The 2014 risk assessment Q&A also made some of the following revisions: that risk-based cleanup levels and risk assessments should now be developed using the PRG calculators, and that there would be a consultation process should be followed if somebody is considering using an alternative model for the CERCLA site cleanup. And here is screenshots from the 2014 risk assessment Q&A. The PRG calculators used to develop risk-based PRGs for radionuclides are now recommended by EPA for Superfund remedial radiation risk assessments. And that these risk and dose assessment models are similar to EPA methods for chemical risk assessment. And then it talks a little bit in the next paragraph about it. You're looking at using a different model. There should be a comparison with the PRG runs using the EPA default parameters. And that's what we'll be talking about when we're doing the consultation, and then why there'd be a technical reason to move to this other model. So concluding for incorrect assertion 7, it seems to be based on people continue to misread a 1997 guidance document that we have clarified in two subsequent guidance documents. So don't get why people still make that mistake. So to understand the EPA CERCLA approach, users should read the 2014 guidance and the clarification in the 1999 transmittal memo. And please stop making this mistake. And that's it for that, the end of this webinar. So we have more questions, and hopefully you guys will understand things better, or at least be able to point out if you see someone else making a mistake that I talked about today, and we can keep them from going too far down the road the wrong way.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. So I will remind the audience, we still have some additional time here. If you are in the middle of writing your question, please continue to submit it. If you haven't started one, again, we still have time. So please keep sending those messages into the Q&A. I'm going to start with some of the questions that have come in here, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have allotted today. So, Stuart, one of the attendees noted that you stated earlier cleanup goals are primarily driven by the radiation risk, or, quote, radiation risk usually dwarfs chemical risk. Since the radiation risk and chemical risks are added under CERCLA, why is it required to use the same models when other models, whether they're chemical or radiological, will offer opportunity to include more site-specific parameters?
Well, first of all, I was saying the radiation risk for those radionuclides is generally dwarfs the, if they have any chemical risk, the same radionuclides is usually dwarfed by the radiation risk. The models, why we use the consistent models is because we're trying to protect a similar receptor. So when you go back to RAGS Part A, it's in chapter 10. I think it's either page 10-32 or 10-34. I can't remember. There is a discussion about how the if you don't use the same model when you're doing the risk assessment, you'll bring in incompatibility and inconsistency between your two modeling estimates. And the idea being that you want to have a consistent framework for how you are assessing risks. So when you're adding it together, it's about as consistent as you can be. There are some differences on RAD and chem, some where we have better information on RAD, like gardening, we typically might include on radionuclides, where it's not as done as often on the chem side. And then there's differences between dermal exposure and external exposure. But because we have the same people who work on both sets of tools, particularly at RNL, we have discussions about, well, when you're doing that for dermal, what were some of the underlying assumptions for that? And then we try to sort of match that to the extent we can, that it makes sense on the external side. As far as just being able to add more and more data on the assessment, there's lots of different modeling books or things put out by NAS or other groups that talk about you want to have the level of complexity that's useful to you're doing your assessment to make decisions, but and generally no more than that, because just having more complexity in a model is a great way just to keep stringing out your analysis and not making decisions sometimes. So That's a thing also that gets cautioned about in some of the NAS documents.
Okay. We have a question here. In many cases, the EPA radiation PRGs are less than background. And they say at the same time, EPA considers the Uranium Mill Tailings Radiation Control Act, so UMTRCA, their radium cleanup levels of 5 picocuries per gram over a background. So they're simplifying as they simplify, but they just say that that's often considered an ARAR. They've never really understood it. Why not require cleanups to background? There is greater risk from the radium than other radionuclides that require cleanup to background.
Yeah. Okay. So the UMTRCA, that's the statute you were talking about. That regulation came out in 1983. I believe the risk assessment for that was done in 1979. It's a while back, and I have a copy of the risk assessment on our SharePoint site. But the it not done like in a way that would be consistent with how we've done things under CERCLA now. So we were using it as an ARR years ago, decades ago. We were often using it. I would say pretty much almost all the radium cleanups I see now are risk-based. And often where you have a lot of exposure, particularly on, say, we're doing a lot of uranium mine cleanup at tribal sites. And if it's, say, a residential area and you start accounting for additional exposures that tribal representatives may have from additional consuming of food that's locally, locally grown, living on the site longer than the typical American, you're often seeing cleanups to background for radium for those sites.
Okay.
But it's our policy that if background for the contaminant is higher than the contaminant we're addressing, say like for radium-226, then we don't clean up below background, we clean to background. So that's talked about in some of our guidance documents and also back in the NCP preamble back in 1990.
Okay. All right. How do the EPA guidelines interact with the NRC's 25 millirem per year? If the requirement is to hit 12 millirem in addition to a risk-based 10 to the minus 4?
No, it's not. The requirement is not to hit 12 millirem. So the idea is that the 12 millirem, which is an ARAR evaluation tool, basically says that you cannot rely on any ARAR that is above 12 millirem to say that is just protective. So okay. If you find that the NRC rule at your site is also an ARAR, then you have to do a risk assessment, starting with PRGs at 10 to the minus 6, and ending up within the cancer risk range based on, say, using a PRG calculator. And then you would, if it's an ARAR, you would then do a calculation to see if those concentrations meet the 25 millirem standard using the DCC calculator, because we use that for our ARARs. If it was completely, but if you're under the NRC regulatory framework and NRC is reviewing you, they would be using D&D screen and RASRAD. But when we're using dose-based standards as ARRs, we use the DCC calculators to try and be as consistent on our dose assessment as we are with our chem and rad risk assessment.
Okay. If we were looking at a DOE performance assessment and we wanted to convert risk, is it assumed that 12 millirem over 30 years equals 3 times 10 to the minus 4 ELCR? They go on to say that they heard the risk can vary by an order of magnitude by isotope. So yes. They wanted to know, is it documented which isotopes represent an order of magnitude higher risk and which represent an order of magnitude lower risk?
Well, there was an analysis that documented it that we cite in our 1997 guidance. In that document, that analysis was done, I believe it's dated like 1993 or 1994. I don't remember the title of it. I worked with somebody else on it, but it's been so long I can't remember the title. But I know we reference it in the 1997 guidance. And it's one of those things about why we don't just convert from dose to risk, because it's all over the map.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a, if you're making a regulatory determination, like you're working on a regulation and you're saying, well, it's going to be a dose of blank, what is the risk of that? Then it might make sense to do that. But for Superfund, when we have site-specific risk assessments, now we should be doing the risk assessment using the EPA tools and using the risk coefficients or slope factors.
Okay. Let's move on. This one is in reference to your sixth assertion. They wondered, what is EPA's position regarding the use of ResRad models versus the PRG slash DCC and the BPRG slash BDCC calculators for assessing radiological dose and cancer risks within the framework for CERCLA documentation? And they specifically provide the example of FUSRAP.
Our guidance for regions is they should be using the PRG and DCC and BPRG calculators. But if they are looking at a situation where they want to use ResRad or ResRad build for portion of the risk assessment, they should consult. I can say that there are cases where we have agreed they can use it for portions of the risk assessment. Usually it's something that's it's a route of exposure that's not covered in the EPA tools, but they still use the EPA tools for the rest of it. And since that consultation process came out in 2014, I haven't had any instances where we switched out of using EPA tools and used just the DOE tools. There are cases where we run both, just because EPA and say the state want to see the numbers run in both in the two different calculators to make themselves satisfied. But because the only way to switch out, the only way it would make sense would be if there's a technical reason to move away from the EPA tools, even though the EPA tools were saying the cleanup concentration that you're looking at was outside the risk range and not protective. But for some reason, we should use, say, that DOE tool, or sometimes the people want to use the ORNL RIS calculator. It only makes sense to switch away from that when, if there's a good technical reason why the situation you're addressing is better served by using another tool. Because it's a kind of a high bar to get out of our regulatory compliance tools if they say you're not protective, unless there's a really good reason that you can show a justification for why that is at that site, that our tool is not the one you should be using. You should be using this other tool to still do a circle risk assessment. So one thing to remember on the DOE tools, they're not, let's say, set up for defaults for EPA circle risk assessments. They also they work a lot with NRC, so a lot of the assumptions in there are more appropriate for the NRC assessment and not CERCLA. So you have to really be an expert on circle risk assessment to use one of these other tools and bring it and make it consistent with our approach. So
Okay.
then usually they, when you do that, they're a lot similar, the results in a lot of the scenarios. So.
Okay. Getting back to the PRG calculator, one of the attendees wanted to know, does the PRG calculator account for a dependency of radiological contamination between soil and the surrounding environmental media over time? They want to know, does it stimulate, or pardon me, simulate radiological ingrowth and decay in addition to considering different transport speeds of radionuclides in a decay chain to ensure that there's a mass balance? What about considering the radionuclides that leach out from soil that get transported to deeper soils and then transporting from groundwater aquifers over to a well?
Yeah, so that's getting into like two general approaches on modeling. So the EPA tools like PRG calculator and the RSL calculator, they're what we call steady state. So when you're doing a risk assessment, it's assuming the contamination stays there. So it's not moving around, it's not running off and being diluted and not going into soil to groundwater. If you do look at soil to groundwater, you do a separate calculation for that because for the EPA tools, we're using the reasonable maximum exposure scenario. So it's an upper bound person. So it's a conservative assumption to assume that the material is staying there. Now, if it were to dilute or move around, most places it would become less, but some places it would concentrate and become more. So we just used a conservative assumption that that it stays in one spot. In the NRC world, the average member of the critical group, they are assuming the source depletion because they're looking for an average number, not the high end exposed person. So that's the default that is going on in ResRed tools. I believe it's also in D&D tools too, but it's not what we're doing on the CERCLA side for both either chemical or radiation risk assessment. And so these are the kind of differences, and there are a lot of little differences like this, but they have big impacts when you're doing risk assessment, which you would have to totally be familiar with to try and use a different model in our approach, where our models are, of course, geared towards doing the risk assessment the CERCLA way, where another model will be geared towards using another approach like NRCs, and then you have to totally change the model to get it to work in our system to be correct. And it can be difficult.
Okay. Well, speaking of ResRed, one of the attendees asked, what's the end calculation result if you're using the two calculators, PRG and ResRed, providing that all the inputs are the same?
You can try to get the inputs as consistent as possible. To get them all the same would be difficult because they sometimes cover different things. I think ResRed has I believe it's three fruits and vegetables, and the PRG calculator has 25. I think they have about five farm animals. I think we have 14. So trying to get them to match up, I mean, that's a kind of a food comparison, so it's easier to remember that. But there are differences all along the way that would be harder to explain. I mean, so you can't get them to totally match up. If you are trying to look at one of the other tools, you can try and keep changing parameters to get them to match up as much as possible, but they never completely match up. But it depends on which radionuclides and which scenario you're dealing with. Will they come out very similar, or will the fact that there were some differences in the way they're set up and that you couldn't get them to match up, does that actually have a real significant change? And that varies, which is why if you want to look at using the other model, we say we have to get into a site-specific comparison. It's because what the comparison on one site with one set of radionuclides and one land use would not really port over to the next site.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to go over here to another question. It came in a while ago. Part of it is observation from one user's experience with some models, and they're looking for your input on this. So they stay and bear with me. I'm doing okay with some of the acronyms, but Stuart, correct me on a couple of these here. So they say, in my experience, the sample density, rigor, and thoroughness of site characterization and remediation resulting from robust applications of MARSIM, MARSAME, and MARLAP, hoping I've got those three right, reduces the uncertainty significantly over corresponding chemical remedial responses to such a degree that the resulting rad risk range calculation is overly stated, and it's conservative relative to that for the chemical contaminants. And they just wondered, is there any effort right now to consider these differences?
That would be, so MARLAP, we'll say MARSIM and MARSAME are radiation survey guidance. They're consensus federal guidance that's developed by our radiation program, ARIA, working with other agencies and states. MARLAP is their consensus document for laboratory protocols for radiation analysis and labs. As far as the radiation and chemical folks on getting together and trying to harmonize more of their survey procedures, I am not aware of those efforts. I'm more on the risk assessment end. And so we actually have, say, like our radiation lab in Montgomery, so I talk with John Griggs there, and Dave Kappelman, our ERT group in our office, who's work on the survey issues. I've not been aware of any move to try and consolidate anything with the Chem folks on that. I would say there's a lot of number of little differences. The the commenter was asking about the survey procedure differences, and even when you get into things like slope factors for chemicals, there's differences between how they were done for different chemicals, and of course there's differences from radionuclides. And for that person was bringing up the comment about thinking that the radiation survey procedure is more conservative. I know on the flip side, a lot of the chemicals, or most of the chemicals, have margins of safety in the slope factors, which they don't have in radiation because they're based on human health, their best estimates. And so some people complain that those are not as conservative as the way they were done for chemicals. So there's lots of little differences across this differences on a lot of the underlying science. We try to add them together when we're doing the risk assessment, still knowing that there, you know, there's differences between the two. But I'm not aware of any move to harmonize survey procedures. And the risk assessment guidance Q&A that I've talked about, there is a discussion, though, that when you're doing surveys at a site, radionuclides and chemicals, there are two general approaches. So MARSM has an area averaging component. So you can look, and then there's also the approach of not to exceed. So you pick a number, whatever the cleanup concentration, you can't go above that in any spot, or you can't go above it more than a factor of two or three, which might be called a hotspot criteria. Or you could be doing area averaging, where you look over the area of contamination and average the contamination together into a single cleanup level. So you could be a little bit above and a little bit below in different spots. I know in our guidance, where we do have harmonization there, we say whatever the approach you're using, whether it's not to exceed or whether it's area averaging for radionuclides and chemicals, you use the same one if it's the same location. Because sometimes people would want to use the area averaging component because it's in MARSM, and then we'd use not to exceed for chemicals that were co-located. And really, you should be using area averaging or not to exceed based on the land use. So if you're worried about somebody sitting down on one spot, like a backyard and gardening in one spot, you often use not to exceed. If you think people are going to be moving around pretty regularly, you might be using area averaging instead. So to the extent, so there, I should say there, that is the where we did do a harmonization that's talked about in the risk assessment Q&A. Okay. But beyond that, of where the commenter wanted, I don't believe that's being worked on. If it is, I'm not aware of it.
Okay. And we did have a clarification that came in from some DOE attendees. They just wanted to confirm that MARSAME and MARSM are actually guidance manuals that should be followed. I just wanted to share that comment.
Well, yeah. So they are listed in the risk assessment Q&A. So they're not technically Superfund guidance, but so we don't push people to use them in mass in a Superfund context. But because they're mentioned in the Q&A, there's no need to consult with headquarters if you're using one of them. So we know they're being used. We're comfortable with them, but we're not saying you have to use them at all of our sites. But if you are using them, it's unlike, say, using a different model. So we don't mention ResRad in the risk assessment Q&A, and that was on purpose. But we did mention MARSM and MARLAB. That is on purpose because we know those are being used and we're comfortable with them. Even if we're not recommending use them all the time, you don't have to consult if you're using them with us.
Okay. All right. I do recognize we've got about 15 minutes or so left in our session today. So I'm going to try to get through a few more questions here. I want to thank you, Stuart, for hanging in. There are still a couple more here in the queue. I'm going to try to group them together as best I can. This one seems to be standing alone on its own as the first person asking about this. One of the attendees noted in 2020, EPA introduced what they called, quote, peak PRGD. Could you explain what this is intended to do and how it might impact risk calculation?
Oh, peak PRG was just using more sophisticated method Bateman equations for looking at the decay and ingrowth of radionuclides over time. And when you run the peak PRG, defaults towards the maximum risk, whenever that is, for that set of radionuclides or for that radionuclide and its daughters or progeny that it's in the chain. So that could be from the first day, or it could be sometime in the future, 1,000 years, 10,000 years. You can also cut it off too. So if you want to just do the risk assessment, say going the ingrowth and decay over 100 years or 1,000 years, so you can cut it off. You could get to the same answers using the previous version of the calculator, and we talk about that. Our RNL talks about that in the technical manual, how you could get the similar results, but this is just a way that makes it easier and a little bit more precise.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go to a few questions of comparing PRG to other standards or other agency numbers. So this first one is asking, given that there are differences in EPA and NRC policies and the underpinnings of their models, they say if a singular radionuclide model yields a significantly different cleanup goal or release criteria, it appears that one is either over-conservative or one is non-protective. And they wanted to know what would EPA stance be? Which one would we go with?
We go as a starting point with the tools that we recommended, so the PRG or DCC tools. And as far as saying whether one's protective or one's overly conservative, you have to understand too that A, we have different targets, starting points than NRC. NRC starts off when they're doing their runs. If you look at their screening tables, they're based on 25 millirem. So that's the high end of what they consider acceptable. You look at any default table we have for risk base, and it's 10 to minus 6. So it's more the de minimis level. We're not doing the table of 10 to minus 4. Although sometimes when people are doing, say, emergency response or time critical removals, they may have tables of 10 to minus 4. That's a different program that works with us. But on the remedial program, we're looking at different target levels, and of course they're dose-based and we're risk-based. Also, again, we're protecting different individuals. We're using the reasonable maximum exposure scenario. We use upper bound persons, and this is what we use in Superfund. There's policies going back to the 90s from our deputy administrator about generally we're using upper bound individuals. We're looking at individual risk, and NRC is using average members of critical group. There is a whole host of other differences. I mean, things like we use the reasonably anticipated land use. So we're trying to determine what we think the land will be used for. So for Superfund cleanup since the mid-90s, when the reasonably anticipated the land use directive came out on May 25th, 1995, we've been using reasonably anticipated land use except when it's not cost effective or practical to reach a protective level for that land use, and then we go to more restrictive land use. So I would say our unrestricted releases are, residential, agricultural, or probably in the 20%, 20, 25%, I top of my head, but it's definitely below 50% for our cleanups, where NRC is using resident farmer almost all the time. So they're using unrestricted release. So there are so many little differences on how we do our cleanups. There was an NCRP report. Was it in the late 90s or the early 2000s? It was one NCRP report 146. And Strom was head of that. And they went through to all the little differences between the EPA and NRC programs. So when they were saying, we're trying to compare them, you have to look at all these differences, not just focus on one thing like just the cleanup level or just the land use or just the conservatism of the receptor for the risk or dose assessment.
Well, how about the National Priority Drinking Water Standards? They want to know if you can speak to interplay between the PRG risk assessment calculations and the drinking water standards of 15 picocuries per liter, alpha per beta, 4 millirem, beta per photon emitters, combined radium. I won't keep going. I think you know what they're referencing here. Would you just use the more stringent between the two for determining cleanup levels for your quote beneficial reuse?
When you're doing the soil, we're running the PRG calculator, soil to groundwater, you get results based on both the ARR, which would be, the MCL, so that for alpha emitters or the beta photon emitter, if, I think for the beta photon emitters, there's like 171 of them. We have concentrations for each one built in the calculator. And you also get a soil to groundwater leaching number based on risk. So that would, of course, be 10 to minus 6 if you were using the contaminated water for things like drinking or irrigating your backyard garden, that kind of stuff. Typically, for cleanup levels, for potential or current sources of drinking water, we use the ARAR, which would be the drinking water standards. But there is a policy that you can go beyond the ARAR to a more stringent level if there's good reasons on why the exposure routes, the exposure that you envision at the site, the MCL might not be protected. But that's still, you go through a consultation process for that. And that was also a guidance document that came out the same day as the cleanup levels for the establishment of cleanup levels for CERCLA sites that came out in August 22nd, 1997. But I don't think I have that one as a link, but we could add yet another link, Gene. We could get like 31 or 32. Those guidance documents were linked because we came out with them the exact same day, and I remember that because they were so much fun to work with OGC on.
Well, we do have some questions on references or other resources. So, since you were talking about links, I'm going to jump over to some of these questions. One of the participants really wanted to thank you for the numerous resources that you provided, but they noted that the majority are for human health risk assessment, and they wondered if there were links you'll be adding or recommending for ecological risk assessment.
That's a good question. So, we have a draft ecological risk assessment calculator for radionuclides that, because we've done so many changes on the human health, we did not finish it. And that is a pet peeve of mine to get that restarted and over across the finish line. So I don't have them on this talk. I would hope that we could finish that calculator in the next couple of years, maybe. I will not swear to that because other things keep bumping it out of the way. Mainly, the reason it doesn't get done is because the human health for radiation is almost always going to be the driver or the thing that's most important on making the CERCLA decision. So I've always focused on the things, getting those things done that are most likely going to have the most impact at a Superfund site. And it probably is not going to be the radiation risk to eco. But yes, I do want to finish that. We've worked with our folks in our emergency response team in drafting that up. And then we just have never gotten it across the finish line. So sorry about that failure. But hopefully we can get that one done.
What about recommendations for radiation risk assessment for surface water bodies like lakes, rivers, and bottom sediments?
Well, there's it's drinking water. There's still those MCLs that can be ARRs, and if you have need to do a risk assessment, the calculator, the PRG calculator, you can do risk assessments for bodies of water. So, both for fish, if it's like a pond or something like that, ambient water levels, or if you're also using the water for drinking, showering, irrigating your crops. So there is a PRG for in the agricultural scenario derived from water. So water to using for irrigation or for farm animals drinking it or for and humans drinking it and also bathing in it. So that scenario is actually covered in the PRG calculator.
What about background radioactivity level? One of the attendees noted that radioactivity, when we've got radioactive contamination, it's often cleaned up to the background level instead of PRG. They're asking if you can point them to EPA guidelines to determine background radioactivity levels for a site.
Well, I think people are often using MARSM, and then there was also criteria. There were also evaluations, survey procedures, and the soil screening guides for radionuclides from 2000. There is a guidance document on the policy end called "The Role of Background in at CERCLA Sites." It talks about not going below background, but it's not so much of a technical guidance. I would think generally in a survey it's probably more MARSM, but and I would probably have to ask for it to somebody like Dave Kaplman, who's our radiation survey expert, since I don't work on that.
Okay. And then for those who might be brand new or have a limited background in radiation, if they want to learn more about health risk and action levels related to radiation or radioactive contamination, where would you recommend that they start?
Well, if you're in CERCLA, if you were just coming into CERCLA and you want to learn more about CERCLA and the radiation cleanup levels, so you were going to start working on Superfund sites that were radioactively contaminated, I would usually say, I tell people there's a, we have some tools for the community. There's a series of, I think, 22 fact sheets and a community toolkit for radiation risk assessment. And there's a video on that we show to the public on how the risk assessment process works. It talks a little about radionuclides and how they can help. It's a 19-minute video. I say start with the 19-minute video, then I go through the toolkit. If you've never done anything on radiation, because really easy to understand, they're at eighth grade level. And then the next thing I would read is the 2014 guides, the radiation risk assessment CERCLA sites Q&A.
Okay. Now I do see a few other comments. Just some of the questions that have been brought up are stimulating some dialogue amongst our attendees, and they're starting to think how some of the various risk assessment approaches might be limited by costs. There are questions about EPA perhaps shifting how they're running some calculations given some budget limitations. And again, some of those issues with NRC requirements and EPA's own regulations. I do want to acknowledge that there are still a handful of questions or comments that are still in the queue, but we do not have time to address everything today. So, Stuart, I wanted to ask if there is a question or comment that we didn't have time to address during our Q&A section. I see your contact information on this slide. Would it be a safe statement to make that they're welcome to reach out to carry on the conversation or ask other questions?
Yes, particularly emails are better. Just cause.
Okay.
And then Lou can follow up with a phone call if we need it or Teams call. But yeah, every time I do a presentation anywhere, I have that contact information at the end. So yes, people do contact me from webinars to conferences.
All right. Excellent. If it's okay with you, we are coming right near that scheduled end time. So I think what I'm going to do is go ahead and close out our Q&A section. I do have a few final reminders, including some announcements for upcoming webinars related to our topic. So before I take control over Stuart, any final thoughts you want to leave them with?
No, I'm just glad that people were able to stay awake for 2 hours.
Oh, Stuart, ever the entertaining presenter. Thank you. So with that, what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to take back control here, and we'll go ahead and walk through a few quick reminders before we close out today's broadcast. So the first thing I wanted to do is let you know that Stuart will be back later on this year to join us for two future webinars, one on April 17th, where he'll talk about EPA Superfund Remedial Program's approach for addressing radioactive contamination, and then another one on May 22nd, where we'll talk about the Superfund Remedial Program's approach for risk harmonization when we're addressing chemical and radioactive contamination at sites. Based on the questions I saw during today's webinar, I think these two will be of interest to attendees. I'll be sure to include links to these in the follow-up emails that I send out when we post the archive from today's webinar, but I wanted to put those dates up on the screen and encourage you to save those dates and sign up. I do also want to encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org. We collect information related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. I also encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. I hope that you will sign up for that newsletter so that you can be informed when sessions like today's webinar are available for free registration. Now, as I pointed out at the beginning of today's session, we do have a unique seminar homepage. So if you're wondering where all of these links are that Stuart has been referencing, they are on the website shown in red on the top of this slide. It's the same URL that we pointed you to when we set up, when you signed up for today's session. It's the same URL you went to check in. It's the same URL I emailed you in my reminder messages. It's the same place we'll encourage you to go to, and the archive is available. So you feel free to bookmark that website. And then again, I encourage you to scroll through the page and carefully get to the section to either download the slides and references or to jump straight to that very comprehensive list of related resources and links. You might find scrolling up and down or using these plus or minus icons will help expand the section. For those of you looking for copies of certificates of participation, you'll need to visit this seminar homepage and click on the section for the feedback form and complete the online feedback form. If you complete the online feedback form and check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire delivery, as soon as you submit your feedback form, you'll then have access to a certificate of participation that you can either download or print out for your own records. If you don't check that box, we will not issue a certificate. If you happen to be sharing the line with others at your location, you can actually give the URL shown in red, that seminar homepage URL, to anybody who sat with you, and they can scroll down to that feedback form area, fill out that form, and then get their own participation certificate, even though they didn't register independently. And if you happen to be one of the lucky individuals watching the recorded version of today's webinar, right about now in the online archive, in the upper right above my head, there should be a button to the seminar feedback form. You can click that button now and fill out the feedback form based on your replay of the recorded version. Again, checking the box at the bottom, certifying you replayed the entire session. And then once you submit your feedback, you too can have a participation certificate for your own records based on watching the archive session. Please be sure to share your thoughts. We really do read each and every one of those submissions to help ensure that we can improve the quality of our seminars in the future. So with that, again, I'll remind everybody the seminar homepage will be available from today forward. You'll find the slides, a collection of resources, information for Stuart, as well as a link to that feedback form where you can share your thoughts based on the live session or the archive. I will send an automatic email when the recorded version is available. It usually takes me about 1 to 2 weeks. And from there, you'll be able to forward it on to other colleagues that will find this a valuable resource as well. So with that, I want to thank the nearly 320 live individuals who joined us from across the United States for today's session. And as well, I want to thank the fabulous Stuart Walker for sharing his time and expertise today. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.